Log Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and whoever has kids shouting in the background, a special welcome to you. Good afternoon, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host for the next 90 minutes. This is a special in our News in Review series, a chance to look back at some news events in detail. Our show today concerns a case out of Miami Beach, Florida, that somehow seems to have been missed by the mainstream media. The thumbnail sketch? A trigger-happy Miami Beach cop kills two young, and unarmed men in the space of 4 days. How can this happen? Last time I checked, this was the 21st century, not the Wild West. Helping us make some sense of what happened on June the 14th and 4 days later, we have a great panel of experts. Joining us from Florida, we have trial attorney John Contini, and I am hoping that his co-counsel, Greg Sams, will be joining us shortly. They're acting as co-counsel for the two families who lost young men in this madness. Good afternoon, John, and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Simon, for providing this forum. I cannot thank you enough for exposing for everybody to hear the actual truth of what's going on down there in Miami Beach Police Department.
Well, we're going to give it our best shot. I do believe we also have Sama Shahada on the line. He was actually standing next to his brother when he was killed in cold blood. Sama, firstly, let me offer my sympathies to you and your family, and thank you for taking part in this program.
Thank you, Simon. Appreciate you doing this program.
No problem. I do know we have a couple of other people on the line, but for those of you who are listening in, we had some real bad technical difficulties in the 10 minutes leading up to the show. So I'm going to let the rest of the panel introduce themselves. We do have Lawrence McCoy's mother on the line, I believe.
Yes.
Gina Becker.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Gina. It is very nice to talk to you. And again, let me extend my sympathies to you and your family. That this must have come as a huge shock to you.
Yes, it's still a shock. I don't think it's let up yet. But, and I do want to thank you too, Simon and John Contini, for working on this and putting this on the air.
I do believe I've left out one person. There is someone I haven't introduced. Or maybe not.
No, not on this side.
Okay. All right. We have our current panel. All right. As always, our switchboard is open, and we invite listeners to call in with their questions and comments. Our switchboard number is area code 646-378-1120. We also have our chat room open, and you're most welcome to ask your questions in there, or just hang out. Okay, on with the program. This story actually hit my radar a couple of weeks ago. To say I'm shocked does not do it justice. In the space of 4 days, Miami Beach cop Adam Tavis sent two unarmed 29-year-olds to meet their maker. Of course, it's a well-known saying that there are three versions to every story. There's mine, there's yours, and somewhere in the middle lays the truth. John, can you give us the thumbnail sketch of what happened in these two situations?
Yes, I would. I'll try to be very succinct. There are two different homicides, and they really are not excusable or justifiable. They are outright executions, frankly, that happened on June 14th, and that was when Hussein Shahada was executed by the Miami Beach police. And 4 days later, on June 18th, Lawrence McCoy Jr. was summarily dispatched into eternity himself. Same officer involved in both executions. Now, the second shooting with Lawrence McCoy, there were apparently two other shooters, but Adam Tabbs was, in fact, one of them, according to the Miami Beach PD. The question is begged, why would you give the same police officer back his gun and his badge within 72 hours and put him back on the street so 4 days after the first execution, he could be in a position to kill again? That's exactly what happened. He was put in the position with his gun, with his badge, to kill yet again. And unfortunately, in even fairness to that officer for just a moment, the officer is not allowed to decompress in a situation like that. No officer
exactly.
should be put back on the road, even if his intentions had been good. And let's, for a moment, just hypothetically imagine an officer who's just either incompetent or not trained properly or has been working a 14-hour shift, like in the case with the Shahada execution on June 14th. He had been on a 14-hour shift because of cutbacks, and he apparently wasn't trained properly. He'd only been a police officer 3 years, folks, and he had two different domestic violence incidents in his past, and yet they hired him. They hired him anyway, despite the two different domestic violence incidents in his past. He was hired. Now, whether he got anger management, whether he had anything to address his proclivities for temper or violence, we don't know. All we know is he was hired nonetheless by the Miami Beach Police Department. After he was hired by the Miami Beach Police Department, he must not have been trained properly. And on top of that, even pretending he was made to work a 14-hour shift, and we're going to get into the facts in a moment as to why he apparently felt as though he could shoot Hussein Shahada. But even after that killing that we're going to get into, they put him on a desk for only 3 days. Apparently, they say they put him through a psychological test. Whether it lasted 30 seconds, 3 minutes, we don't know how long that psychological test lasted. All we know is they put him back on the street with his gun and his badge, ready to, you know, sport all the typical accoutrements of a law enforcement officer. He gets in his car. He goes out to work again on the fourth day after Shahada execution. He shoots again. Only this time, there are 9 to 11 projectiles that pierced the body of Lawrence McCoy. We don't know whether two of them were entrance or exit wounds, both. All we know is there are at least 9 entrance wounds, and there are at least 9 exit wounds. Total of 9 to 11 bullets pierced Lawrence McCoy's body, and he was unarmed also. And we know for a fact that they were defensive wounds. We know for a fact they were defensive wounds, meaning they're up and down his forearms, 2 in the face, 2 in the back, and the buttocks, the lower back, and under his right arm, under his right armpit, which means, please, listen, please, no background noise, please, which means he was covering up his face. As he's being shot in the face, he's covering up with his arms. That's the only way to get a bullet in the armpit. He's cowering, he's covering, these are defensive wounds, and is shot in the back as well twice. Now, his father, Lawrence McCoy, has said, you wouldn't even do a dog that way. That's what his father said, and his father is right. And if that were a dog that was shot 9 to 11 times, the SPA, you know, the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and PETA would be all over this thing internationally if that was an animal that was butchered like that. And Michael Vick, the pro football player Michael Vick, did time in Atlanta prison for cruelty to a dog. More time while this officer's still on the police force, still getting paid. Now, that's 4 days apart. Now, he's not the only shooter in the second shooting, and we're going to get into that, too. Suffice it to say, both men were unarmed, both were 29. Let's go back to Hussein Shahada. He's down there with Samer, his brother. They weren't just brothers. These guys are best friends. They talked every day. And they're on vacation. This was their dream vacation. And you're going to have Natasha on the line. You're going to have Carlia. Their fiancés were with them, walking behind them, as women will often walk and talk and be involved in their own conversation. And they heard the shots. And the women ran ahead. And all they heard were a bunch of civilians saying, they killed them for no reason. They killed them for no reason. They killed them for no reason. That's what the women heard. And when they tried to inquire as to who, after they heard the shots, and they heard those comments from the citizens, they were not told which brother was shot. All they were told was, you're coming with us. And the police rousted them up, essentially kidnapped the women, falsely imprisoned the women, and asked the women whether or not Hussein Shahada had been speaking Arabic earlier that evening, as though that would have any relevance whatsoever to the execution. And we have a video. We have a videotape that, Simon, you have on your system, and I'm gonna let you speak in just a moment, but please tell the folks how they can go and watch the actual killing video, which fortuitously we have, only by happenstance, because a nightclub next door happened to film the sidewalk, and we have that video that shows Hussein Shahada with his hands in the air trying to comply with a stop request by this Adam Taves in the Miami Beach police officers, and he stops, he turns around, he puts his hands in the air just like he was ordered to do, and the next thing you know, you see him blown into eternity, literally blown off camera, and his brother Samer, who's on the line, had to see all that, had to experience that.
Oh, it's horrific, and I will make sure that there is a link to the video when I put up the text wrap-up to this show, and that will be available on www.bloggernews.net. I have switchboard that is lighting up like a Christmas tree. I do want to ask those folks that have called in to just bear with us for a couple of minutes. Before I bring any callers on, I want to talk to Samer. Samer, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Samer. Please speak up.
Yes, I'm here.
Can you tell us about what happened at 4:30 a.m. on June the 14th? You and your brother were walking along a sidewalk.
We were just, you know, walking, and next thing I know, about seven police officers surround us with their guns drawn, saying, stop, don't move, being really, you know, loud. But the one that was loudest was Taz. That's why we both turned towards his direction. Put our hands up, you know, we were side by side. And the next thing I know, you know, I heard a couple gunshots. So, you know, I went to the ground, and I saw my brother was on the ground. I didn't really realize he had been shot. Until he kind of lifted his head up and blood started coming out of his mouth. Then he turned his face towards me, and my face was towards him, and I can see him take a breath. And he didn't, his eyes were still open, and he couldn't take any more breaths after that. I went hysterical and started shaking him and crying and saying, you know, help my brother, help my brother. So then the police came and grabbed me. Put me up against the car, and my brother was still lying on the ground. And nobody was helping him. And I was pleading with them, you know, help my brother, help my brother. And then they roughed me up and started cussing at me and roughed me up into the car. And as a matter of fact, you can hear all this going on because my phone accidentally started doing some voice recordings. And you can hear the police cussing at me and roughing me up and all that stuff.
I do have those recordings, I believe. And I do plan on posting them online, so that everyone can share them.
And on one of the recorders, the police officer also says that he didn't find anything on my brother. So
right.
I had kind of known that my brother was dead, so to speak. But, you know, you don't really accept it until somebody comes and says, yeah, he's dead. So the whole time, you know, they put me into this interrogation room and they tell me that, you know, my brother's in critical condition and he'll probably pull through. And I'm in this interrogation room for about 5 or 6 hours. And the whole time they're telling me this, that he'll probably be all right. The only way I find out was I hear my brother's girlfriend on the other side of the interrogation room crying. And I yell through it, you know, why you crying? Why you crying? And she says, Hassan's dead. Hassan's dead. So I lost it again. You know, I'm in a room, confined, for no reason. Not, you know, they weren't arresting me. They would just lock me into this room for 5 hours. So again, I lost it. I kind of broke the interrogation room window. And as I'm bleeding, they're getting mad at me because I'm getting blood on the walls. In the meantime, I just found out my brother died. And then,
well, that was a lie from the pit of hell that they told him, Simon. His brother was pronounced dead on scene, and meanwhile, they kept him for 6 to 8 hours in a room, falsely imprisoning Sammer, kidnapping him, essentially violating all of his civil rights. They had him in cuffs, handcuffs, for what? For watching his brother get executed in front of him? And they're lying through their teeth, saying, your brother's going to pull through, he's going to be all right. Meanwhile, they pronounced them dead at the scene. And this is what they had. The two women in other rooms had kidnapped them, had falsely imprisoned them, had threatened them with arrest every time those two fiancés wanted to leave and go to the hospital. And this is the kind of treatment that the Miami Beach Police Department gave these witnesses. They're witnesses. They're not suspects. They're not suspects. He watched his brother essentially executed in front of him, and he's telling us that he's watched the blood come out of his brother's mouth. He's seen the life leave his eyes. And how is he rewarded with this? They cuff him. The profanities, you can hear the audio recordings as they're saying, get the F in the police car, and they're swearing, get the F in the car, while you hear Sammer praying in Arabic. And Yarub, Yarub, please save my brother. God, please save my brother. We have 26 different audio recordings, a minute and a half each, that were recorded on his BlackBerry fortuitously, and he never did it on purpose. It takes too many moves to record on a BlackBerry. It just happened. He prayed, God, give me a sign. Days later, he finds out days later that all of this is recorded on his BlackBerry in the police car while
Thank
he's cuffed.
Lord.
For no reason at all, he's cuffed. He's handcuffed, thrown in the police car. You can hear the cursing. Then you hear the officer say to the other officer, we didn't find anything. We didn't find anything. You hear that on the audio recordings.
It's scary. I really do need to bring on some of the callers. They've been patiently waiting. And I have free long distance, but they may not. Let's start off with area code 727. Okay, let's move on. We have another caller coming in from the 703 area code. 703, are you with us?
Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your name and what's your question or comment?
My question is, they arrested him and they didn't have any reason to arrest him.
Yes, so who's the caller?
Sam or the brother? My name is Nancy.
Okay. Yeah, there's no reason. About 8 hours later, into the next day, they alleged that they found out that there was a pushing incident involving his girlfriend, Carlia. Carlia and Sammer both were questioned about whether they had a domestic, but they don't even discuss an alleged domestic between them until about 8 hours after the death of Hussein. So the question is begged, even if they had a legitimate reason to arrest Sammer for domestic, can you remove the background noise, please?
I wish I could. I think it might be the wedding reception.
Well, the person there at the wedding has to walk away from all the other people at the reception. They're going to have
I'm very
to do that.
Far. I'm very far from them. They're just very
okay.
loud.
All
I
right.
Apologize.
Just thank you, Gina. But real quick, even if there were grounds to have a charge against Sammer for domestic violence with his girlfriend, the girlfriend has publicly stated that it did not happen. And the charge was dropped later by the state attorney's office. That charge was not even in the mind of a police officer until 6 to 8 hours after the death of Hussein, meaning they're scrambling to come up with, what did you brothers do all evening? What did you do with your girlfriends? They questioned the girlfriends for hours and hours and hours, and they found out that there may have been an argument earlier that night, but that has nothing to do with why his brother was killed in front of Sammer. And the question is begged, then, why did you have Sammer in handcuffs the moment the brother was killed? Why was he cuffed? Why was he thrown in the car? Why was he incarcerated for 6 to 8 hours? Why? There's no explanation whatsoever, except that they wanted him away from the media. They wanted the girlfriends away from the media. They wanted to control the situation and keep any witness that could put the truth out there away from folks like Simon, folks like even the mainstream media. They wanted to control what they had just done. In my opinion, it's classic cover-up modalities.
Can I ask another question?
Certainly.
If I can make a comment on that.
Sure.
First off, they put the girls and put them under alias names at the hotel. They said for protection, but it was a cop that shot my brother. It wasn't some thug. So the police knew where the girls were at.
Keep the media away.
Keep the media away. And then second of all, they made up this charge, and they locked me up. So if you can just imagine my mind state, I just seen my brother get killed. Now I can't even grieve like a normal human, because I'm in a jail cell for 2 days around, a whole bunch of guys laughing and joking because, their charges, my charges, it wasn't anything serious, but I'm around a whole bunch of people laughing and joking, and in the meantime, I'm going through the worst thing in my life. So I can't even be around my family, and I can't even grieve like a normal person would want to grieve at that point in time. And I don't think that was right in and of itself.
So they didn't put the girls in jail. They took them to a hotel.
Well, no, the hotel rooms, Simon, they moved the girls out of their hotel room at the Lowe's Hotel, which is not a flunky flea-bid hotel. This is $246 a night. These four people, these two couples had a dream vacation for about 4 days. They went to restaurants, went swimming in the ocean. They were having a great time, nice hotel. They moved the girls to another room. Why would the police do that? Very simple. They wanted to keep them away from the media so that nobody in the media could find them and question them. That's our opinion. They wanted to illegally search the room, which we have evidence that they did, in fact, do that. Bottom line is they violated the civil rights of both Natasha and Carlia and Sammer for about the next 6 to 8 hours before taking Sammer to jail inappropriately. So they get the false arrest of Sammer. You've got the false imprisonment of all three of them. The girls were threatened. When I say girls, I mean the young women were threatened with arrest. If they left the room, the little holding cell in the police department, these little interview rooms, we'll call them little interview rooms, but let's face it, except for the bars, it's a holding cell because you're not free to leave. Whenever you're not free to leave, you're under arrest. You're in custody.
I want to come back to that because I think that's very germane to the entire psyche, but I have my switchboard just alight. Area code 540, what's your name and what's your question or comment for us? Hello, 540.
Hello,
you're on the air. What's your name and what is your question or comment?
Oh, I'm Simon. This is Natasha Johnson. I'm Shahida's girlfriend.
Natasha, how nice to talk to you. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I'm very sad that we're having this conversation.
Right.
Tell us what happened from your perspective.
Well, what happened that night was me and Carlia, Hassan and Samra, they was going out in front of us. So we all decided to go back out. We left out, and me and Carlia was behind Hassan and Samra. We was walking, and as Hassan and Samra was in front of us, we was, like, walking behind. And then as me and Carly see these police cars just fly past us, and as the police cars was flying past us, we was turning on Washington Ave, and all I did was hear 3 gunshots. And then as I'm running towards the scene, the lights of the police cars, I'm like, I wonder what's going on. And then so at this time, I'm hollering for Hassan and Samer because we can't, you know, we don't see them. So it's this girl, she walks past us, and she was like, oh, my God, the police just shot this guy for nothing. And I was like, what does he look like? And she was explaining, she was describing his attire, and I was like, oh, my God. And I was like, I think that's my boyfriend. So I started running. And as I was running to the scene, the police, as I was about to cross over, the police said, ma'am, come here. And I was like, can you please tell me if that's my boyfriend or not? He was like, tell me what your boyfriend looks like. And I explained, described his attire, what he had on. And next thing I know, they just grabbed me and said, come on, you have to go to the police station. And I was like, why? They was like, just go to the police station. So the police escorted me across the street to the police station. And from that point, they had me in this room for hours. I mean, hours at a time. They just sit there. They was like, tell me some information. They was asking me all these questions about what's his name and everything. So I was like, why are you asking me these questions? Is it my boyfriend? They started yelling at me, talking about, look, we don't know yet. I was like, so why am I here? And I had Hassan's cell phone with me. And the phone rings, and I see Sarah's name comes up on a caller ID. So I was like, oh, my God, it might be, you know, one of them. I'm like, it's Sarah or something. So I answer the phone. I was like, hello. And when I said hello, that's when a detective came and grabbed the phone from me. And I remember hearing Samer say, oh, my God, I thought you was dead. And the detective did not tell Samer, like, no, this is not your brother. This is the police. He was just like, where are you at? And then Samer said, I'm locked up. And that's when they ran out the room and went to where Samer was at. So I was like, could you tell me if that's my boyfriend, Hassan? But I knew it was him because I heard what Samer said. I thought she was dead. And at this point, they still kept telling me, we don't know if it's him. Then later on, they were telling me that he was in critical condition, that they was going to take me to see him. And then so I kept on asking, when can I see him? And they started getting so frustrated with me. And they just wouldn't give me no answers at all.
Did they keep you for 6 to 8 hours in that room?
No. From that time I was in that room, I remember looking at the clock. It was like, I think it was like 7 or 7 something that I was in that room. From 4 something to 7 something in that room.
Did they ask you whether or not the men were speaking Arabic?
Yes, sir. That's when I went to the other room. They switched me out of room to a different room. And
they were asking
locked
you,
me in the room.
Are you sure? Let me ask you again, and please walk away from the background noise, Gina. Are you sure?
I'm trying, but we're in the middle of the transport.
You're going to have to do something different.
Okay. Do you want me to go ahead and hang up?
Are you sure? Let me ask you again. Are you sure that they asked you, the police asked you, whether the men were speaking Arabic earlier that evening?
Yes.
Okay. And did you try to leave and did they let you leave the room to go to the hospital?
I tried to leave. They wouldn't let me leave. I told them, I said, I thought you guys said that you was going to take me. And that's when they started, like, getting attitudes with me. They was like, look, I told you we don't know if it's him or not. But yet they told me that he was in critical condition. And they would not talk to me at all.
Did they ever threaten you or Carlia with arrest?
If we leave, yes. If I was to leave, they was going to arrest me. They took a picture of me. They got a mugshot of me.
Oh, my God.
And I asked them why. They told me it was their procedure.
Oh, well, we'll see if they can explain that in court one day. Simon, you were going to answer something. Simon, did you want your picture taken? Just go down to Miami Beach PD and inquire about this case and see how fast they take your picture.
Yep. Right. Is this one of those holiday deals that only Miami Beach PD offers?
But this was their dream vacation. I'm not being smart-mouthed, but let me tell you, it turned into their worst nightmare. These people went to the Sawgrass Mall, world-famous mall, that day. They were shopping. Carlia and Natasha went to BB, the store. The men bought them nice outfits. The men sat in the food court, had pizza like a lot of guys would do because they don't spend money on themselves. They just took the girls shopping. Then they all went to a nice disco that night. They went to a nice club, Sobeys. They did some dancing. This was their dream vacation. They saved for months for this. And this is how it ended that same night.
Let me say, it was for my birthday. We went out there for my birthday.
This must have been just the most horrific thing that has ever happened in your life.
Yes.
I don't want to compromise what John is doing, but Natasha, do you feel like filing some sort of suit against Miami Beach PD?
Yes, because I feel that it was just so wrong. I mean, they have no reason to just go up and just kill somebody for no reason. It's just like they just shoot and ask questions later. I don't understand.
Natasha, were you with him for 6 years as a couple?
Yes.
That's a long time. You were planning to get married and have a life together.
Yes.
Yes.
That is just awful. Natasha, please stay on the line with us. I do want to try and get to some of these other callers. I have so many people coming in from the 703 area code that what I'm going to do is give the next three digits as well. 703-798. Are you with us?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Carlia Carpel. I'm the girlfriend of Samra Shahada. I was with Tasha that night as well.
Oh, thank you so much for calling in. Tell us what happened to you.
Well, it was pretty much the same thing Tasha said, you know, when we rolled up to the scene. I remember not knowing if it was my boyfriend or his brother. And I remember a lot of witnesses repeating they killed him for no reason. I remember, you know, calling my aunt on the cell phone, you know, trying to tell her something had happened, and I remember the detective telling me to hang up, and come with me. You know, they took us into the police station. They kept us in there for hours, but on my way into the police station, I want to mention there was a witness who was trying to get my attention to tell me that he had saw what happened, and the police told him he couldn't talk to me as they escorted me in the room. So they said that he wasn't allowed to have any contact with us. They separated each and every one of us, well, me and Tasha, because we were in there together. They confiscated my cell phone. They confiscated my cell phone as I watched them walk around the police station eating bagels, drinking, I guess, coffee, whatever they were eating, just keep walking past looking. I had to use the restroom, and the lady said she had to come with me so I wouldn't hurt myself. And I said, why would I hurt myself? And I kept asking the condition of, you know, because my boyfriend actually called my phone. So I knew at that point it wasn't him. So I kept asking questions, you know, with the status of a sin, is he okay? He told me he was in critical condition. They never said that he died. I told them I had to leave. I told them about 7 times I had to leave. One cop told me, I remember this exactly. I said, I'm going to leave. He said, well, you're going to get arrested. I said, well, then you're going to have to do what you have to do. He said, well, go ahead because I'm in the arresting mood today. I remember they confiscated my phone. I remember them walking by laughing like I wasn't even sitting there. Every time I asked where Tasha was, they said, Tasha who? I said, Tasha, the one you brought me in the police station with. And then I remember them putting me in a room right in front of the crime scene outside the window. So every time I got up to look, all I seen was blood on the sidewalk. You know, they told me that, you know, I couldn't make a phone call. I told them that I have a child at home. I need to call my mother. She was hysterical calling around. Finally, when they did release us, they told me if I didn't sign a paper to search the room, I asked them if I had to sign the paper, and they said, if you want to be released. If you don't sign the paper, you won't be released. And also to go back to what Tasha said about taking the picture.
Carlia, let me stop you. They gave you your purse back. They brought you your purse, which was in the room, and they had you sign the form after they gave you the purse, which means they're having you sign the form authorizing them to search the room long after they had already searched the room because they bought you your purse. Isn't that right?
Well, what they bought me was I had my cell phone had died, so they bought me my because I had my purse, I had my smaller purse, so they brought me my, they bought Tasha's purse. It was Tasha
Bottom line. Bottom line is they went in the room, searched the room, brought you things from the room, and then had you sign the form after the fact. Isn't that right?
Right.
Is that right? Now, did that officer say I'm in the arresting mood? Is that what you said? You were talking very fast, but I want to make sure.
Yeah, he did. He said he was in the arresting mood.
Did he make any mention as to why he might arrest you?
He said if I get up and walk out that police station, and I kept asking if I was under arrest, and he told me, shut up and don't move.
Whoa, I don't like that. John, I'm not a lawyer, but...
Simon, if you did that, Simon, if you took a woman from one room to another, Simon, for a person, it's kidnapping. If you look at the kidnapping statute in Florida... Anything that falls within the purview of the kidnapping statute is moving a person from one place to another against their consent or against their will. False imprisonment is if you don't let them leave the room when they want to leave the room. If you had done that, Simon, you would be in prison right now. So would I. Now, yet they're doing it with impunity. Why? Because they want to control the situation. They don't want these people out there talking to the media. They want to control the facts. So they can spin it the way they wanted to, and their police information officer, their PIO, fancy phrase for risk management, the guy's a cross-dresser, basically, he's out there putting it out there in the street that these people may have had guns, and they spin it, and they demonize the Hussein Shahadas of the world, and later on when we get into McCoy, they demonized him too. What they do is they control the events, they isolate the witnesses like Carly and Natasha and Samer. They falsely imprison them, they put them in little rooms, and they threaten them with arrest, as they did in this case, if they try to leave. And then they put out in their own report to the media what they say happened to poison the well, Simon.
Oh, I agree with you. I do have to get some more callers, but John, I want you to think about something, because at some point during the afternoon, I can guarantee it's going to come up, the race card.
Well, I apologize. I'm not playing that card, but they brought up, and Carlia, correct me if I'm wrong, Natasha said they did. Did they, in fact,
they
ask
did.
You whether... Say it again.
If he spoke Arabic to anyone, if he spoke Arabic...
That night?
Yeah, they asked me if both him or him, if Hassan spoke Arabic, I hear Samer speaking Arabic, and I said, what does that have to do with anything?
Right. Like I said, I want to come back to this because I really think the race card.
But can I just say one last thing? I just wanted to tell you also, when I was in the police station, there was a gentleman that I noticed that was walking around. He was eating bagels, drinking coffee. He walked past my room about four different times, and he wasn't a police officer. And I heard him say at the end, they said, thank you for your cooperation, and he was free to go.
Well,
he was the bartender or the bouncer there. Yeah, that's his name. He put an application with the Miami police.
Oh, yes. That is a whole different story, isn't it, John?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Simon.
Let's go to another 703 area code. It's 703-910.
Yes.
Hi. What's your name and what's your question or comment for us?
First of all, my name is LV. I would like to give my love and condolences to Samer Shahada and his family, and also give a brief about Hassan Shahada. He was loved by many. I've known him for a lot of years. He respected the law, never had any problems. His brother, family loved him. I loved him. And it's a tragic situation. And I've been following up on all of the articles, and everything is just, it's ludicrous, everything that they're saying. It doesn't even fit the venue or description of Hassan or Samer. And it's just a tragic situation.
Yes, Simon, let me chime in. I used to be a bigoted, I think, in my own thinking. If I heard a name like Hussein, and in my own ignorance, in my own fear after 9/11, I think, and this is Contini again, being honest, I think it resonated within me a certain fear and a certain prejudice on some level. Now, I have to be honest and say that stayed with me for too many years. Now, when I met the Shahada family and I saw how sweet they were and how they reminded me of my own family, the how close they were, there were about 30 of them in the room and they were trying to feed me. And the more I learned about Hussein, that he was born and raised here, guys.
Yes.
The question about whether or not he spoke Arabic earlier that evening, why that stinks to high heaven. This is a young man who's an American citizen who had his own little limousine company who drove a congressman around Washington, D.C., where he lived in Woodbridge, Virginia, where he actually was a legitimate American businessman. The Shahada family is a sweet family that were raised here in America from Palestinian descent, just like my people come from Italy and Ireland originally, but I was raised here and they're raised here. And what difference does it make if I was speaking Italian earlier that night or they're speaking Arabic earlier that night? How does that play into why you would execute an unarmed man with his hands in the air?
Oh, it makes no sense whatsoever. All right, I've got to get to these phone lines. I mean, otherwise we're going to be making Mar Bell a fortune.
I thank you all for hearing me.
No problem. Area code 786, what's your name and what's your question or comment for us?
Hello, good afternoon. This is Attorney Greg Sands. I'm also one of the lawyers.
Greg, I am so glad you could join us. I do have a question for you. I'm sure you've been listening in. What can you and John actually do? I mean, is it possible to bring some sort of criminal case, or does this have to be civil?
Well, if it's going to be a criminal matter, what we've been trying to do is to get the U.S. Attorney's Office involved. We've called on them. I've spoken with them. I have a certain U.S. attorney that is a liaison with me who I'm informing on each fact as it becomes known to us. And so if there's ever going to be a criminal prosecution, it's going to have to come from either the state attorney's office, which is not going to happen, I can just tell you that, or what we're hoping for is that the U.S. attorney's office will file criminal civil rights violations. So we are imploring them to become involved. We're working on angles in D.C. and well as in Miami, and we know that it's being reviewed, but that's all we can say at this particular time.
Is there anything that the men in the street, the listeners today, can do to help these cases forward?
Well, one of the things that they can do, I know that John has helped establish a website to assist and to donate money for the defense, and what that would do is that would empower us to continue our investigation because we are also going to be pursuing civil rights violations in the civil context as well. So that's what we're looking to do, and of course that is going to cost money. There's some witnesses that we know about that we're going to have to go and talk to and locate that are in another country. So things of that nature, you know, and all that is necessary. And whenever you're fighting a governmental entity such as the Miami Beach Police Department, the City of Miami Beach is what we're going to be doing, money is no object for them. They can do what they want. If they feel like they want to send up a helicopter to get air shots, they do. Whatever they need to do, whatever resources they need to have to defend those cops, they have. We are limited, on the other hand, which is one reason why we want the U.S. attorneys to join in so that they can use the power that they have and the resources they have to bring to bear on this situation. But largely in these types of police shootings, private entities such as John and myself, we're the ones that have to expose it. We're the ones that have to go out and investigate it. We're the ones that have to file the lawsuit and go to court and try to bring justice to this situation, which is not necessarily financially fair if you look at it, us against the City of Miami Beach. So that's one thing that everyone can do. To stay knowledgeable through the website about what we're doing, we're thinking about doing some social things such as boycotting, things of that nature, and citizens can assist us with that if that's something that we're going to do. So there are some things that citizens can do, but they have to stay aware of where the case is going through the website.
Simon, let me brag about Greg Sams for one moment, please. Look in today's Miami Herald, please. Everybody, Google Greg Sams, SAMMS, in Miami Herald. Today, thank God, he was able to help a homeless man who was shot, 9 times, I think it was, or maybe 11. And that homeless man, a disabled vet, was killed by Miami Beach PD. And Greg Sams, today, it's in the Herald, secured a wonderful result for that family, thank God. And that is today, of all days of your show, Simon, look at Greg Sams and look at that article today in the Herald. Now, I'm blessed to have his help. He is a co-counsel, yes, but the truth is he's a civil rights lawyer expert. Thank God we have him. And, Greg, I'm not trying to embarrass you, but I want the callers and the people listening to know that Greg is right. When he says go to www.justiceforshahada.com and www.justiceformccoy.com, and we'll spell those later, if you learn about these young men, you learn about their lives, their biographies, who they really were. If you really want to know these two young men and who you'd be donating toward their causes respectively, look at those sites, learn about these men, their families. The money does not go to Greg Sams. It doesn't go to John Contini. It doesn't go to lawyers. That money is going to go to police experts who used to be police chiefs who now testify to what is fair, what is unfair, what is proper procedure, what is not proper procedure. And they're very expensive, and no one on the street can afford these people up against the government without your help. And the last thing I'll say, Greg is also right. We cannot sue these cities, any city, without putting them on notice first. For 6 months, they're supposed to use that six-month period under 768. They're supposed to investigate themselves. But I say to you, that's like asking the Al-Qaeda to find Osama bin Laden. They're not going to investigate themselves. They almost never do. So Greg Sams just told you it ain't going to happen without the federal government's help. I tend to agree with him.
Greg,
is
this Tavis deal a rogue cop, or is this a symptom of a deeper problem in the Miami Beach PD?
Well, let me tell you, that's such a great question that you asked, because every time something like this happens, police chiefs and all the lawyers that defend them and the mayor of the different cities in which they work always try to place the incident as an isolated one. They'll always say, if the cop was bad and he did wrong, this is an isolated incident. It's not reflective of the department. I don't care what department you go to, Los Angeles, New York City, Dallas. Every time the cops blow people away, shoot them in the back, whatever they do, that's their defense. That's what they say. It's not symptomatic of the department. This is just one incident. That is such a lie. The Miami Beach Police Department, like practically every police department in South Florida, is full of allegations of excessive force. Wrongful shootings has been going on for years. This city has exploded, what, 6-7 times from riots? Each one of those riots, guess why they occurred? Police misconduct. Shooting people in the back. Shooting people wrongfully. That's what happened. So it is symptomatic. Miami Beach Police is beating people on a regular basis. I just know it from my practice, just me alone and all the calls I get. I sued them in the past 2-3 times. I can't even remember how many times the people who call me about Miami Beach beating them, doing them wrong. I mean, so, yes, it's part of a systematic problem, and it begins with the fact that each time a wrongdoing occurs, the police cover it up, from the chief on down. In this particular case, look what happened here. 4 days after the shooting, this police officer was back on the street. 4 days! This is one of the most questionable shootings I've ever seen. The video itself, in less than 2 seconds, the young man is shot. He didn't have time to move. He didn't have time to react. He didn't have time to reach for anything. He was blown away in front of your face. And you're going to clear that in 4 days? He's going to be back on the street in 4 days? And then shortly after that, the police chief gives a press conference saying, I find that both Shahada and McCoy acted aggressively. You found that already? And if you found that already, why are you still investigating, and why can't we have all the materials you have? What are you investigating? You already cleared him. You cleared him in 4 days. 4 lives a day. He's back on the street shooting at someone else. Let me tell you something. In the history of my research in this area, I have never seen, and I'm talking never, ever, have I seen a police officer shoot somebody and 4 days later is back on the street. Never. It's not. Think about that. It's not even fair to the police officer who did it. Because obviously, if you kill somebody, aren't you traumatized? For his sake, should he not be off the football now? Shouldn't he be behind a desk just for his sake? Who shoots somebody at 4 days later to go back out? Unless you're in the army and you shoot people on a regular basis, who does that? And every army person that comes home who has been in the war zone, are they not traumatized?
You know, what really bothers me is I've seen the video. We have Sama Chahada on the line with us, and you know, the video and Sama's story hold water. You know, they were walking down the street. They stopped when they were told to stop. They turned round when they were told to turn round. And, you know, 2 seconds later, Hussein Shahada disappears from the frame. And it's not that he's running away.
And Simon, what makes it worse is Samer made it very clear. It disrespects his family. It disrespects the investigation to put Tavs back in the force 3 days later. It was adding insult to injury to the Shahada family. If it was not bad enough to lose their son the way they lost him, and then to have the same officer put back on the street, almost encouraging that kind of behavior, almost validating what he had done, encouraging other officers perhaps to act similarly in the future. It was such disrespect for the Shahada family. It made their pain exponentially worse. And then to the McCoy family, they wonder whether their son would be alive today if that officer had not been put back in the street. Yes, he was only one of three shooters, but still, how many of his projectiles pierced their son's body? Would McCoy be alive today? Greg Sams taught me one thing. He taught me about failure to discipline. You can have liability on a city like this, not just for failure to what they call negligent hiring, hiring someone like Tavs that had domestic violence priors in his life before they hired him. That's putting him out after 3 years as an officer only, negligent retention. Then you also have negligent training. But worse than that all is what they call failure to discipline. When you have failure to discipline, what does that tell you, Simon, and your callers? It tells all the other officers, 385 officers, only one of whom is Arabic, by the way, and you tell all those other officers, it's okay to do this because we don't discipline. If you look at the other 6 to 8 shootings, failure to discipline is classic liability for a department because it sends a message. Go for it, guys. Shoot first, ask questions later. And
what you're saying is that, that this is not a rogue guy, that this is just a symptom of a much larger...
Don't put all your eggs, nobody out there listening to this, don't put all your eggs in the Adam Taves basket, because to do that is number one, Greg Sams was correct again. In fairness to the officer, whoever it is, they need to be able to decompress. And making him work a 14-hour shift because of budget cuts until 4:30 in the morning is too much for most people. But let's pretend for a moment that guy in his own mind, in whatever delusional fatigue he was experiencing, imagine he saw something that we can see on video he never saw. Just forget that for a moment. You don't put him back on the street. Failure to discipline, failure to investigate. Why? You send a terrible message to the community. The whole culture and subculture in Miami is poisoned. And it also shows the symptomatic thing that you're discussing, Simon, that the entire, from the neck down, the body is sick, has cancer systemically. If you can't remove the little baby toe, you know, the little localized cancer cells, let's say the Adam Tavs, the officer involved is just one piece of it. But it's systemic. It's throughout the department that an officer could feel as though if he's put back in the street 3 days later, he's thinking to himself, well, whatever I did there with the Shahada thing couldn't have been all that bad, really, because, look, they give me my gun back. They put me on the street. I'm if anything, I'm feeling more emboldened, more strengthened, more like a hero, if you will. I'm being rewarded, if you will, by my behavior.
Okay,
so,
I still have this huge switchboard problem, and I do apologize for all of the people that are on hold. Trust me, I am getting to you as quickly as I possibly can.
What Mr. Contini said?
Sure.
I was around the police for 2 days, and it wasn't just tasks. They were all extremely aggressive, every single one of them. And to make a point, when I actually got finally taken to the jail cell, and I told the security guard my story, she told me Miami Beach is going to get in a lot of trouble. They're always extremely aggressive. And this is a security guard at the jail saying this. Two of them actually said it. She told me they're too aggressive. They rough people up all the time. They break people's jaws. They do stuff. And this is from a Miami, you know, correctional officer that said this. And it was a complete slap in the face for him to be back on duty 4 days later. I mean, this is my brother that got killed, and he's back on duty 4 days later. It's over aggressiveness by all of them.
Yeah, I think it's brutal. Okay, area code 205. What's your name and what's your question or comment for us? Hello, 205. Ah.
That is Mr. McCoy. That is the father of Mr. McCoy, I believe. Is Lawrence Mac McCoy listening?
Okay, let's come back to that. Let's go to area code 954.
Hi, this is Lee. Lee Cohn, how are you?
Oh, hello, Lee. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I'm the investigator that works with John Contini and Greg Sams.
Right.
And
we're
in charge of gathering all the information that the police are not, unfortunately, releasing, and finding out a lot of things that controvert public statements that are made by the police chief and other people that speak for the police. For instance, if I might, we've located two other witnesses that were in a car that was allegedly collided with the car that Mr. McCoy allegedly hijacked, that has not been released to the public. We've learned that the police have never ever bothered to speak to eyewitnesses in the 11th Street Diner that were actually eyewitnesses to the shooting of Mr. Shahada. We've learned that there are other witnesses that saw the hijacking that have not been released to the public, and we have spoken to them. These things, of course, will be coming out, as the moments to trial, take place. There's a lot of other things that we've been uncovering just by doing good hard work on the street. And basically we're learning, just like Greg said and John has said before me, that these officers are not doing these things for no reason. They're doing them because they can get away with it, basically, and that's because the city officials, police, in their internal investigations, intentionally hide police records that show patterns and practices of misconduct. And for that reason, the culture of being able to shoot people rather than use restraint and respect the public takes a back seat.
Bullets are cheap.
Well, Simon, Lee Cohn, thank God, found that video, the killing video. We wouldn't have that if it weren't for Lee Cohn. Let me tell you something. It was us that released it to you, Simon, and to all the Main Street media. If it wasn't for us giving that killing video to the media, no one would know about it because the police tried very hard to take Valentino Erickson, the nightclub manager of Twist, the nightclub that had the video, and they tried to remove his equipment. They actually told him that he needed it, and he, thank God, he was strong enough to say, well, you need a subpoena. I really need this stuff. This is my footage. And that allowed us to get in there the next day and get that video. That's only because Lee Cohn's been on the street doing the things that the police would never have us know, like Lawrence McCoy never had a gun. You realize they put it out there that this boy, Lawrence McCoy, had a gun, that he came out of a cab shooting at police? Then we find out the truth that the police have now had to admit he was 400 yards away on foot. He never had a gun, and they admit that now, but meanwhile they poisoned the well for a week. The whole public in Miami thought that there was a guy with a cab who came out shooting with a gun. So the public naturally goes away, and they go back to sleep, and they go on to the next case thinking, well, that guy had it coming. Meanwhile, they were lied to, a lie from the pit of hell. Simon, he had no gun.
Neither had any weapons, as I understand.
Exactly,
I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, there's some story about a wooden coat hanger, but, let's keep that for another show. I think that deserves a show all by itself. I am still trying to wade through the vast number of callers. We have...
I want to say one more thing. Lee Cohn,
okay.
Simon, you have to hear from him. He looked at McCoy's body, and I don't want to be indelicate here, but I have to be a little bit indelicate. Lee Cohn examined McCoy's body in the morgue with David Rank. David Rank was 24 years a homicide prosecutor for Miami. He resigned. He went to the morgue with Lee Cohn, looked at McCoy's body, thank God, before it was cremated, and saw the 9 different entrance and exit wounds in the face, the lower back, under the armpit. If it wasn't for Lee Cohn doing that, and David Rank, who resigned from the Rundle's office, the state attorney's office, and David Rank's been retained, and he jumped in the pool and he helped us. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't know about his body being riddled 400 yards away on foot. And his father, Lawrence McCoy, who's listening, the father said you wouldn't even do a dog that way. And he's right. If that was a dog, you'd have PETA and every group in the world all over this thing.
Right. Wasn't the original police press release something like, you know, 2 bullets or 3 bullets?
Yeah, they said a few. And they said it was right out. I'm sorry. We're not laughing at. We're just outraged. It would be funny if it wasn't so sad and pathetically violent. And I'm just wanting to say publicly, and then I'm going to give it up to you guys. And we have assembled the right team between Greg Sams, who's a civil rights expert, been a Miami lawyer for 30 years, Lee Cohn, who's been on the street, you know, so valuable. And we got Dave Rank, who resigned from the state attorney's office, homicide for 24 years, who jumped in the pool and helped the McCoy family, especially. And you got the Shahada family and the McCoy family, never knew each other, and they brought together by fate, and these people are talking to each other now. They're two sweet families. Please go to justiceforshahada.com, and please go to justiceformccoy.com. Please go to those sites, and please look at them.
I do encourage all of our listeners to do that. Okay, back to the phone lines, which just don't seem to want to go away. Area code 703-730. You're on the air. What's your name? Hello, area code 703-730.
Is there a McCoy family member on the line? McCoy.
Okay, let's move on, because we still have lots of people to get to. We have someone coming in from the 754 area code, and we have a lot of wedding going on in the background.
That's 754, that's me.
Okay, what's your name and what's your question or comment for us?
Well, my name is Dan, and John Contini knows me as Danny. And I just want to say that you got a great show here, and John's a good friend. And what I wanted to share was that five of us from Calvary Chapel in Fort Lauderdale just left the Belglades Correctional Facility on a prison ministry mission. And being an ex-convict and knowing myself what abuse and above the law power that the police have and use and utilize, I want to extend our prayers to both families for the whole situation, because we have been following the case.
I'm glad that you are. I mean, it seems to me, and it makes me angry, actually. I don't class Blogger News as being mainstream media. We are hardly anything but mainstream media. But, you know, why isn't this case all over the Nancy Grace show? I mean, this should have her salivating.
Well, because number one, I think it was the investigator who called in previously and said that most of the information stuff regarding the case has been kept secret. They're not going to publicize something like this. It's guys like John Contini who get it out there into the mainstream. And those are the guys that you know, I applaud, because I know John personally, and he's a great man, and I'm glad that he's on the show speaking about this, because I know a lot of innocent men. I know a lot of guilty men, but I also know a lot of innocent men that have been set up by the police.
You know, I spoke at the funeral, Danny, at the McCoy service. And what Martin Luther King said, evil triumphs when good men do nothing. So if we do nothing, if we don't do anything, then we are really part of the problem. We're not part of the solution. And when Greg Sams is filing these 119 public records requests, and Simon, this is important for your listeners to know, they're not giving us any evidence, and they don't have to. They can hide behind what's called the public in the public records law, they can hide behind what's called the open investigation exception. They can say, I'm sorry, it's an ongoing investigation, and they don't have to give it up.
I know all about that exception.
And Greg Sams has been filing these things. We're going to get the radio-to-radio transmissions between the officers talking to each other from shoulder to shoulder. You know how they lean their little face down to their shoulder and they talk into their little mics. And all the dashboard cameras, all that stuff we're going to get. But they're not giving it up easily. It takes guys like Lee Cohn on the street to find these civilian witnesses, and we're hearing things that we're really not prepared to tell everybody on the air now because it's really, really good stuff to expose the lies, frankly, that have been generated from the Miami Beach PD, and we're hearing things that Lee used the word controverted.
John, I just want to say that police and prosecutorial misconduct, which is rampant in this country today, it's a terrible thing. Listen, if a guy's guilty, he's guilty. We know that. There's no secret to being guilty. But if you're innocent, and the local authorities are trying to get their conviction rates up because of the misconduct, hey, listen, you know what? It's not fair. I know plenty of men that are in prison today. And as I said earlier, Freddie Guzman and I just came back from a prison ministry trip. And you know, we know plenty of men that are innocent in jail. We know plenty of guilty men. And that, you know, a lot of guys know that they're guilty. They know where they belong. They know they committed a crime. They've changed their lives, and they're trying to get right with God because of what they did. But it's the innocent men that sit there and say, you know what, listen, how come nobody's ever brought my case up? And like you said, Simon, how come Nancy Grace isn't salivating over this?
It's a very good question. I'm still trying to work my way through the switchboard here. Yet someone else from the 703 area code, 703-499, what's your name and what's your question or comment for us?
Very good question.
Can you pick up rather than use the speakerphone?
Where are you going to park, friend?
I got to go to church.
Oh, okay.
That's what the private function was.
I'll see you.
All right, bro.
Okay, 703-499, what's your name or what's your question for us?
We're getting creative.
Okay, let's move on. We have someone from the 202 area code calling in.
Hello,
202.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes.
Indeed. What's your name and what's your comment or question for us?
This is Abed Ayub. I'm calling from the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. We've been working real close with John. Just my comment out there, you know, this is a tragedy, as everybody's has been saying. But I want to thank John and his team and Greg and Lee for taking the leadership on this, and really, we couldn't have asked for a better team and better representatives of the community, the Arab American community, and they've been a tremendous help and a tremendous asset. And we really encourage everybody to go onto the website, justiceforshehada.com. Read the news, read everything, go on to both websites and make a donation to these families. Because I could tell you it's hard times. We are trying our best to help the families through this, and we need everybody's help.
Hey, Simon, Abed is not just helping the Shahada family. What I really love about this man, Abed Ayub, is he's helping the McCoy family too. He's reached across outside of the Arabic community. He's not just, you know, staying in that little domain of the ADC. He cares so much, and he's helped the McCoy family too, because we're going to use the same experts because we have the same police department and ironically the same officer involved. But Abbott Ayoub is also talking to the federal government for us because we do need help, guys. All your listeners out there, please write letters. And Lee and Greg Sams and Abbott Ayoub, there are people that they can write to and express their feelings about what they'd like to see happen. And perhaps these people that are the elected state attorneys like Catherine Fernandez Rundle in Miami and Gail Levine, the prosecutor assigned to her, who's supposed to be investigating this thing. You know something? If you and I did this, we'd be indicted probably, Simon. If you pulled the trigger.
There is no doubt in my mind. I mean, you and I would be rotting in a jail cell, you know, and the key would be thrown away.
Abbott, I just want you to know that Abbott Ayoub up there in Washington is not just camped out behind his computer screen and on his telephone, you know, playing the ADC Arab American or American Arabic Anti-Discrimination Committee card, which is wonderful in and of itself. I mean, thank God for them. However, he's actually going the extra mile to help both families, and he's actually camped out. He's gone down to DOJ, Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division. He's helping us make our case because, frankly speaking, without some real independent investigation with, like Greg Sam said, serious resources behind them, who's got the money to stay in the game? Typically, it takes citizens. It takes your listeners to reach. Listen, Obama got into office in large measure because a lot of people on the streets raised $5 apiece, door to door to door, $5. It doesn't take much. Keep in mind, the money in these two cases will not go to lawyers. We don't want that money. That money will go to the families to support the actual experts that need to be hired, former police chiefs that need to come into court, raise their right hand and say, this is wrong. These are not the proper protocols. I'm a police chief. I was a police chief for 30 years. We would never allow this. We would discipline, and they would speak with specificity to all the protocols that should have, could have, and would have been followed. And we that costs money.
And overshadowing anything is always the injury. And the injury.
We are trying our best to bring this to the attention of the DOJ. They are aware of it. And we are working with them on almost a daily basis. And hopefully we'll, in due time, be able to give everybody some good news on this investigation. But we just got to keep pushing, and we need everybody's help doing it.
You can rest assured that we will keep pushing.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Someone is playing their computer speakers while they're on the phone. Stop it. It leads for a really nasty echo. Okay.
Can I say one thing about McCoy, please? I talked about
sure.
Hussein Shahada. He was 29 years old. Hussein Shahada was
a
wonderful, wonderful young man who had his own little limousine company. He was, and let me talk to you about Lawrence McCoy, 29 also, went to college in Maryland. He went to Kenya for 9 weeks. He was an adventurist. He only ate organic food. He was a health nut. He was emailing his mother the last several days before his death, Gina Becker, from the library. He was a little down on his luck as far as financially, but he was a nonviolent person. He was a nonviolent person. Nothing in his past speaks to anything remotely like he's alleged to have behaved this night. We're hearing from civilians that they're describing a heavy-set person, stockier in build, light-skinned black male. That's not describing our young man. And suffice it to say, I'm going to stop there except to say that these are two wonderful young men, 29 years each, and they're you'd be proud to have them in your families, all your listeners.
Oh, I'm sure I would. Okay, let's get back to the phones here. Another caller from 703. This is 703-298. What is your name and what's your comment or question for us?
Hi, my name is Nejwa. I'm a San Antonio cousin.
Hello, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring up another angle of everything. I mean, yeah, we were talking about the police officers and how Sam's civil rights were violated. But also looking at it as a family member, I wanted to say his mother was never notified properly. The family was never notified properly. I got a phone call at 10:30 in the morning saying that my sister was hysterically crying, saying that Hassan had been shot and killed, and I didn't understand what she was saying, and there was no more information. So we had to go digging for information. I had to call hospitals in Florida, and I tried to call both cell phones of Hassan and Samer to try and get them on the phone to see if this was some weird mistaken thing, because I couldn't believe that one of them had gotten shot. So not only did they arrest my cousin Samer and put him in a room for 6 hours or 8 hours or however many long it was, and they kept him away from his dying brother, and he was frantic and didn't know what to do. And I mean, we are trying to find out if in fact this is true. I called the hospital. The hospital had no record of Hassan, so then they gave me the number to the medical examiner's number, where I called, and she confirmed that my cousin was there, and they would not give me any more information. And once I knew the reality, I had to rush to my family, so that, because we knew we had to go and see what was going on, because we couldn't reach Samer. We didn't know what happened to Samer. We didn't know that he was being held in a jail cell somewhere. Excuse me? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I heard somebody say something. But, yeah, so we had no idea that Samer was withheld, and we had no idea of how to get in touch with him. So, meanwhile, we're all calling the police station trying to get more information. And the next time we heard from Samer was, like, late that evening. He had called his mother. By that time, my father and my uncle were already in Florida. I had booked them at Florida so they can go and bail Samer out, because we had figured out from us calling. Nobody contacted us again. We had to call. We had to find out the information. So
wow.
It's a lot of things that just, like a domino effect. It was terrible. We didn't know what to do. We couldn't even see. My dad couldn't see Hassan to verify that it was him. I mean, how did they know it was Hassan? Nobody saw him. You know, they didn't let us see it. They didn't let my dad see him.
Simon, they asked her at one point whether or not he was a black fella, and then if you listen to the dispatch calls, one of the dispatchers put it out, two Hispanic guys, two dark guys. Then you see on the forum when they arrested Samer for a bogus charge, which they've since dismissed, they put Arabic, which it's like putting Jewish down. For somebody's, it's inappropriate to put that on a police forum. To describe the person that they're arresting. And asking the women, if they were speaking Arabic that night, there were about four or five instances where, of course, Lawrence McCoy is a young black man, and it's not appropriate to be referring to people by their color or by their faith or by their ethnic or national origin.
Right. When was the last time you saw Catholic or Protestant,
right?
You know, I mean, written on a police form.
Yes, and this poor mother had to learn. Samer is on the line still. He had to tell his mother that his brother was gone, and he ended up just breaking the glass, frankly, in the police department. He was so distraught over what when he was told his brother was dead.
Samer, are you still with us? Actually, I'm not sure he is. Carry on. Oh, no. Someone else has their damn computer speakers on. Turn them off. Okay, let's go to another caller. Someone else coming in from 703. This is 703-595. What's your name and what's your comment?
Hi, my name is Shireen. I'm family of the Shahadas. And first and foremost, I just want to give my condolences to the Shahadas and the McCoys and all the other families that have gone through something like this. Again, I just wanted to say what Nejra has said about being properly notified.
Do you have your computer speakers on?
No, I don't.
Someone does. Turn them off.
Turn off the computer speakers, guys.
Okay, I'm sorry. Try that again.
Again, I just wanted to say exactly what Nejwa had said about being properly notified from either the hospital or even the police about the death of Hussein. The call came in 10:30 in the morning. Everybody's hysterical. No one knew exactly what had happened. And it seemed like a movie. It seemed like, you know, you had to rub your eyes and take a shower just to, you know, for it to dawn on you and to actually think, to have the capacity to think that the police had shot and killed our cousin. And it still is a shock. It's something that we're going to be living with for the rest of our lives. And for this policeman just to walk, literally walk off of the scene and go back to home and take a shower and come back to work the next day or two and to shoot another man, it's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. I mean, the law is, I don't see any law in that. I don't see where the police could even give the man a gun. I don't know, even know why. I don't even know how he became a police officer. It's ridiculous. I work for, you know, the government, and they do background checks on background checks to credit checks to who your parents are, to where you visited in the U.S., all over the world. And for a policeman just to go through this and to become a police with a record of like his, you know, if you read some of the articles, he has a record. And to become a policeman, to have a gun, to be put on the streets, it's ridiculous.
Well, even worse, to be put back on the street, you know, after the 72-hour cooling-off period, and then go blow someone else away.
Yeah, Simon, the only time that's happened in America, a person has shot and killed two different people within 4 days. Unrelated, the only unrelated incidents, the only time that's ever occurred, that person's doing life in prison, or they got the chair, or they've been accused of being a serial killer, or they've been in Iraq somewhere shooting people in the war. It just doesn't happen where a person, law enforcement or otherwise, has ever, in America, ever shot two different people within 4 days apart, unrelated, and not gone to prison, let's say. So that's how crazy this is. And does that mean it's all his fault? No. It's my, if my kids are whacking each other and I do nothing about it, and my little son Johnny whacks Kathleen upside the head and I don't do anything about it, I've encouraged him to go do it again. I put him right back in the room with her, and he whacks Mary, my other daughter. Now, whose fault is that? Is it his? It's mine. I'm the parent. I'm the one that's supposed to discipline. You follow me? It's the department. It's the chief. It's the lieutenants. It's the deputy chiefs. It's the people above them. It's the failure to train. It's the failure to train. It's the failure to discipline. It's them. It's the hierarchy. They're the ones who are responsible.
It most definitely is a symptom of the society that they're in.
Look at your own house. Any one of your listeners, it's your fault. If you've had people underneath you in your house and you're letting them get away with murder, if you will, like in this case, and you do know nothing about it, you put them right back in there, then whose fault is it? You're the sociopath that's putting somebody out there who's doing arguably sociopathic things. And
someone else has their computer speakers on. Can you please turn them off? It leads for a horrible echo. Okay, let's try and take just a few more calls. We've, yet again from the 703 area code. 703-901, what's your name and what's your question for us?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Hello?
Yes.
Yep, you're on air.
Yes, my name is Yasmin. I'm Hashan's sister.
Hi, Yasmin.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to say, you know, this officer has a history of domestic violence, and he's been accused of, from a fellow officer, of using cocaine. So I just don't understand how he, from the first place, became an officer. That's what I'm not understanding, how he became an officer. And, you know, Miami's a place where everyone goes to vacation at. And, you know, they have officers out there protecting people. I don't understand that. I don't know how he became an officer in the first place.
That's actually a very good question. Lee, are you still on the line with us?
Still here. Still here.
Okay, I have a question for you. And I'm not from the Miami area, but as I understand it, there are three very distinct police departments. There's Miami-Dade, there's Miami, and there's Miami Beach.
And there's also, there's literally about, I would say, six or seven other smaller fiefdom police departments in the area, but they're the three biggies.
Oh, they're the three biggies, okay. Have you looked into what any of these departments ask for in the way of background checks on prospective people that they're going to give guns to?
You know, it has a lot to do with salary. It has a lot to do with psychological testing. They put these big dragnet advertisements out on the street, and you get all these people coming in. Nowadays, because of the lower salary, you're liable to get any type of person coming in. They have to be high school graduates, and I think even now they're supposed to be having two-year degrees. But, you know, all the departments are fairly competitive, you know, as far as what they're paying. And you've got the Florida Highway Patrol. You've got the Broward Sheriff's Office. You've got the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office, and they're competitive also in the area. So you've got people that live in Miami that work out up in Palm Beach. But the psychologicals, the different types of things that they have to go through are fairly similar in each department.
Okay, so, you know, one's not more stringent than the other.
Well, we just talked to someone who was in a police department just north of Miami Beach, and he went to the police department in Miami Beach, worked there for about 9 days, saw the horrendous conditions that occurs there, and he went back to where he was.
Wow. Lee, thank you for bringing that up. His name is Ferris. Ferris has sued the department. Lee, thank you for bringing that up. Lee, I'll let you finish this, but they called him, his supervisors, and I want your listeners to hear this. His police officer supervisors at Miami Beach PD, supervisors, called him towelhead, camel jockey, and sand nigger repeatedly, and he lasted 9 days. And he was the second Arabic officer out of 385, and he's gone. And he sued the city since. That's pending right now. And there's only one left. And this is the culture of the same PD that put Tavs back out there on the street to do his thing again. And Lee Cohn has been digging up all kinds of stuff that he's tirelessly on the street helping us. And I want to thank you publicly, Lee.
All right, thanks. You know, I'd like to... The fact, if I could, there have been, since 2007, over 20 police fatal shootings in South Florida.
Wow.
And that does not include Miami-Dade.
Wow.
Okay? There have been paid out $17 million from 1999 to 2008 in settlements for Miami shootings. There are millions of dollars in appeals right now that haven't been settled yet, and there are probably about 15 cases that are waiting trial that are very serious police shootings.
Wow. Okay, I do need to break in just for a second here. We are going to be losing our live listeners in about 45 seconds. But fear not, live listeners. If you go to www.bloggernews.net in about an hour, I will have a link to the recording, and the recording is the whole show,
yeah,
not just the live piece.
If you stay off of Miami Beach, the live listeners can actually stay alive if they actually stay off of Miami Beach.
Okay. Well, I do still have some callers, and I want to try and get through them very quickly. Okay. Again, from the 703 area code, 703-499, what's your name and what's your question for us? Okay, let's rattle right along here. From the 571 area code, what's your name and what's your question for us?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, my name is Jennifer. I'm sorry, I'm joining a little bit late, so I'm not sure if the point's already been made. But there was one thing that I noticed initially from the start of this entire situation was the insinuations of Samer and Hassan's history and the implications that they were criminals and felons and thugs, that they were accosted on the street because they appeared menacing.
Yeah.
The insinuation that they had some sort of criminal history and they got what they deserved. When all in all, and everything that's come out to date has really shown that the criminal in this entire situation was the woman beating, coke using police officer.
Ha! Criminal.
Okay, there seemed to be some audio problems with that. Did anyone pick the question up?
Yeah, she's right. She's right, Simon. They always demonize the person they kill after, and it's up to us to humanize that person.
But I want to throw in a really quick question. It was on my huge list, which, incidentally, I didn't get past the first page. Is Tavis still active, or is he inactive?
If you're going to ask me, this is John Contini, I would not feel comfortable answering that for two reasons. One, whatever they have told us, if they've told us he's inactive, we simply cannot believe not one utterance that ever escapes their lips is worthy of belief. We would have to surveil him to know exactly what he's doing, because no one would have believed that he was back on the street with a gun 3 days later to kill or be involved in another killing that night. And so if we're told now that he's suspended with pay, or that he's not suspended, we haven't even been told that he's suspended with or without pay. The only thing we've been told is that a female PSA, a public service aide, a reserve officer who was involved in the shooting of McCoy, has been suspended without pay, which implicit in that remark is that the other shooters, Celeste, arguably, I believe they said that Taves was certainly one of the other shooters and perhaps his partner. They've mentioned Celeste, but implicit in the remark that she is suspended without pay is the notion that they are getting paid still. And again, you would be in jail right now, and so would I if we were involved in the same situation, Simon. So whether you get pay or not pay, and whether you're actually riding around a police car, we don't know. We'd have to literally follow him, and they're not telling us. Why? Because they can hide behind the ongoing investigation exception. And frankly, we don't know. And we're going to try to get that answer, and we're not going to get it from them and have it be reliable. We have to get it from other sources in order for us to believe it.
Okay. I really have to wrap this show up. It has been an absolutely eye-opening event. I think that's the only way I can view it. In fact, right now I'm thinking that we need to do this again, and we need to do it again real soon.
Well, the last caller, Simon, I'm hanging up now because I have to code too, and that'll allow you to get some more callers, because you're right. I'm I'm saying too much because I'm that outraged, frankly, that McCoy was demonized like Hussein Shahada. They both were demonized, and the public was told that they were felons, that they had criminal priors, that they had guns. Not the furthest from the truth. These are wonderful men. Go to www.justiceformccoy.com and go to justiceforshahada.com. These are businessmen. These were men in McCoy worked odd jobs at the end, but he was still a 29-year-old boy. He was an artist, and he was an adventurist, and he didn't have these priors, no violence, no nothing. And he doesn't even match the description of the person that supposedly pistol-whipped the cab driver, and they never found a gun. And it's just they demonize these people so the public will move on to Law and Order and go back to watching TV or whatever they do. They demonize the person they kill. And
absolutely.
These men have been demonized, Simon, and so you're doing a valuable thing right now by having this show and this forum and to take your recording and to send it everywhere through cyberspace a million times so that everybody knows that these two young men, you'd be proud to have them in your families. They did exemplary things in their life. You know this McCoy fella helped little disadvantaged kids, kids with disabilities? He spent his time, his leisure time doing that. Go look at the website. See what his character. Hussein,
okay. My producer is going to cut my legs off.
Well,
right?
my wife is not my producer, but I know yours is there.
No, my producer is actually in New York.
I'm hanging up now, and I want to say all of you people that are helping, thank you profusely. And Simon Barrett, you are a godsend, frankly, and we can't thank you enough. And I'm going to shut up so the rest of you can talk.
Okay. All right. I really need to wrap this show up. I want to really thank John Contini for dialing in. He obviously offered a great deal of information. Greg Sams, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Greg, I want to thank you for calling in, and I really want to wish you the very best of luck trying to get some justice in these two cases. I am just shocked and horrified by the Shahada and McCoy killings. Something needs to happen, and something needs to happen soon. I also want to thank Lee. Lee, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Lee, thank you so much. And if it wasn't for your hard work, a lot of this information would not have come to pass. I mean, I won't ask how you actually got hold of that incriminating video, but I'm sure it's a good story that we'll talk about one of these days.
Hope so. We will do that.
And to the McCoy and Shahada family members and friends and girlfriends that called in, I want you to know that our hearts and prayers are with you, and Blogger News is not the mainstream news. We don't move from news story to news story. We pick one, we run with it like a dog with a bone. So you can bet there'll be more coming out of us. And we will have links up to all of the things we talked about today in probably a couple of hours. And you'll be able to find that at www.bloggernews.net. This is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy Saturday, or the best Saturday you can have under the circumstances. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll listen again tomorrow when we'll be discussing the Hayley Cummings case. This is Simon saying goodbye.